Talk given Saturday, 19th May, 1973. Maitreyi, said Yajnavalkya, lo, verily, I am about to wander forth from this state. Behold, let me make a final settlement for you and Katyayani. Then spake Maitreyi, if now, sir, this whole earth filled with wealth were mine, would I now thereby be immortal? No, no, said Yajnavalkya, as the life of the rich, even so would your life be. Of immortality, however, there is no hope through wealth. Then spake Maitreyi, what should I do with that through which I may not be immortal? What you know, that indeed explained to me. Then spake Yajnavalkya, though verily you, my lady, were dear to us, you have increased your dearness. Behold, then, I will explain it to you. But while I am expounding, do you seek to ponder thereon. Now note carefully the type of exposition that is given. Something totally alien to our conceptions of exposition. Not for the love of the husband is the husband dear, but for love of the Atma a husband is dear. Not for the love of the wife is a wife dear, but for love of the Atma, a wife is dear. Not for the love of sons are sons dear, but for the love of the Atma, sons are dear. And he repeats that formula with respect to wealth, cattle, Brahmanhood, Kshatrahood, the worlds, the gods, the Vedas, and all beings. And then, lo, verily, not for love of the all is the all dear, but for love of the Atma, the all, everything, is dear. Now, he finishes that section by saying, it is the Atma that should be seen, should be hearkened to, should be thought on, should be pondered on, O Maitreyi. In the Atma's being seen, hearkened to, thought on, understood, this world all is known. And now something very significant. Brahmanhood deserts him who knows Brahmanhood in aught else than the Atma. Kshatrahood deserts him who knows Kshatrahood in aught else than the Atma. The worlds, the gods, the Vedas, beings, everything deserts him who knows everything in aught else than the Atma. This Brahmanhood, Kshatrahood, worlds, gods, Vedas, all beings, everything here is what the Atma is. Now just let's consider those verses. The terms used for translation are husband, wife, sons, cattle, the gods, the Vedas, Brahmanhood, Kshatrahood. Brahmanhood, you understand, every one of you understands. Kshatrahood, meaning the belonging to the Kshatriya caste. The Kshatriyas were the armed forces, they were the rulers, those who wielded power and authority in the land in any and every direction where administration was concerned, where justice was concerned, and so forth. The Brahmins were the priests and the teachers. They were Brahmins. These were the Kshatriyas. The Vaishyas were the merchants, the traders. The Shudras were the workers. Not for the love of the husband is a husband dear. Not for the love of the wife is the wife dear. But for love of the Atma is the husband, the wife dear. Now, who is the husband referred to here by Yajnavalkya? Who is the wife referred to? He, the person, the psychophysical existent, Yajnavalkya, and she, the psychophysical existent, Maitreyi. Was it necessary for a devoted couple who had lived together for so many years? Yajnavalkya must have been nearing 60 or so when he comes to this decision. Was it necessary for him to say what appear to be such trivialities as far as the words go to his wife, who was a highly advanced being herself? Not at all. There is something else. There is something immensely deeper involved in this. Remember that the teachings of the Holy Ones are given fundamentally at the transcendent level, not merely at the psychological or the external physical level. This is what we have to bear in mind always. This is hardly known the world over. When priest and prelate expound and deliver a sermon or write books or whatever it is, or a theologian writes books, he uses intellect, a mind which is conditioned, which he has not looked into in the religious way and realized complete purification before he starts writing or teaching. So you can produce wonderfully learned tomes, intellectually, psychologically, which can be applied to our psychophysical life within the context of mortality, of finitude. But the Holy Ones taught at the transcendent level, in the context of the immortal, the infinite, above all the unconditioned, which means that the mind was utterly purified. Don't restrict this word purified merely to the moral level. That, of course, is taken for granted. That's the absolute ABC, first year in the kindergarten. You see, Their teachings were given at the transcendent level. Now, whenever they give teachings like this, which usually start with the phrase, in the beginning, rest assured that that phrase, in the beginning, represents you yourself in the state of perfect communion, the ultimate samadhi, in which there is the utter stillness and silence of your whole being, the utterly pure state, the unresisting, infinitely resilient state of consciousness, of awareness is a better word in this context, where what is commonly the I myself, as the subject who is looking on, is absent. You are taken up into that transcendence, which is the absolute all, indescribable and inconceivable, the unknown, and which remains unknowable by mind. But you are in that state. Now there is always the return journey back to ordinary everyday life. That means to the functioning of the body, the senses, the brain, and the discursive mind, the talking mind. And the talk is necessary because it is that faculty of speech which is the most important instrument of the brain in the process of integrating all the sense impressions and making sense out of the finite mortal world of separate particulars. This body lives in that state. You can't escape that. So you have to have mastery over that. As a matter of fact, otherwise the next bus will claim another victim. But where awareness, consciousness is concerned, something far beyond mind in the ordinary sense, or even in the great sense of the brilliant intellector and genius and so forth, there are no limitations. There you can bridge that gulf, you can cross the abyss from the finite limited into the infinite unconditioned. And it is not you who cross it. Remember, there is no particular separate you crossing it, because insofar as a finite you crosses, you are crossing from one finitude to another finitude. In the absolute all, everything disappears that we know of. Everything, completely. Make no mistake about it. That is why, where the religious life is concerned, there is absolutely nothing for me, the separate person. And if you cannot get that clearly into your awareness, inner awareness, so that it becomes second nature to you, and as a matter of course, so to say, and you live by it, don't approach religion in the deep sense. In fact, you won't be able to approach it. It's like trying to produce a Beethoven symphony when you can only take a couple of sticks and make a noise on a tin plate. Now, in the beginning means you are in that state, the state of realized transcendence. Now there's the coming back, the journey back here. And in the process of this journeying back, that awareness being, I'm hyphenating the words, that awareness being, which functions in terms of the unitary wholeness of the one total reality, now undergoes proliferation. Now consciousness, in our sense of the word, comes into play. Out of the one emerges two, and out of the two emerge four, and out of the four, 40, and out of the 40, infinite multitudes of particulars emerge. This is the consciousness process. And it is of this that the scriptures have talked of as the creation of the world, the creation of the universe. They didn't even know that there were things like galaxies in those days. They certainly saw a few stars, and they thought they all ran round the earth. The earth was the fixed point. It wasn't that sort of creation they were talking of. They were talking of what happens to you, your consciousness, your awareness, as it makes that entry into transcendence and comes back to ordinary sense mind consciousness. That is what the heart of religion is about, nothing else. It's very hard to get hold of this point. This is what completely differentiates religion from art, science, philosophy. The context of religion is transcendence, immortality, infinity, non-finitude. Art, science, philosophy function in the context of finitude, of mortality, of the conditioned state. The unconditioned is unknown to art, science, and philosophy in this religious sense. So now, when this return journey takes place, consciousness comes into operation, and the awareness of one gives place to two and three and so on. There are varying descriptions given of this return journey. Genesis, for example, particularly in chapter 1 and in chapter 2, gives its own presentation. The creation hymn of the Rig Veda, I'm talking of the famous creation hymn of the Rig Veda, book 10, number 129, gives its own presentation, which is purely in metaphysical terms and in terms of the transformation of consciousness. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad gives its presentation. Now here, we have this very famous teaching. I have quoted the first verse to you time and again. In the beginning, this world was Atma alone in the form of a person. Now don't immediately picture a man with a head and body and all the rest of it. In the form of a person. What sort of a person was this? The word person describes a state. And the word, the Sanskrit word, is Purusha. And the writer or the original teacher of this part of the Upanishad gives an extraordinary, performs a piece of linguistic jugglery to tell you the meaning of the word Purusha. But it is extremely instructive, because formally he, actually he's referring to himself and what happened to him. Because formally, and the word for formally is purva, because formally He burnt out all evil-mindedness in him. Sarvam papanam, all evil-mindedness. Burnt out, and the Sanskrit root for the verb to burn is ush. So he combines the pur of purva with this Sanskrit root, ush, and manufactures the term purusha to represent a person. Your philologist quite legitimately won't accept that sort of thing. But your sensible man of religion will take the hint. The true meaning of person is he in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out, the purified one. That is the person. Now this is the real worth. It is this which makes a man, in the true sense of the term, the heavenly man, the Adam Kadmon of the Kabbalah. You see? All right. So this is the Purusha. Looking around, the Upanishad says, and seeing no other than himself, well, obviously he couldn't, if he was in that unitary state, he said, I am. Now this is another way of signifying to the sensible religia, of signifying to him, what is the meaning of selfhood, I am. The only reality of self, the reality which is eternal, which is total, is the totality itself. The particular is born and it dies. What's the good of the particular saying for 50, 60, 100 years, I am, I am? Because inevitably, absolutely, comes the point when I am not dead. The Lord of Death puts you back into your proper place, which is nowhere, nothing. Make no mistake about that. Not annihilation, but the complete dissolution of a fixed form. No fixity in the life process. Otherwise it isn't life. It is a corpse. No fixity. Right, says I am. Then the next verse says, he was afraid. Now can you imagine this absolute Atma being afraid? These are just ways of talking in order to instruct the sensible religia. Therefore, one who is alone is afraid. This one then thought to himself, since there is nothing else than myself, of what am I afraid? Thereupon, verily, his fear departed, for of what should he have been afraid? Assuredly, it is from a second that fear arises. In other words, the origin of fear and the conflict engendered in fear and the ignorance engendered in the situation is due to the consciousness of otherness. If here now I can really see that and recognize the separate particulars as separate particulars without being overwhelmed by the sense of otherness, which means I am aware, awake to the relationships between this myself and everything else around me, then there is no fear. The conditioning, the effect of otherness is out. The limiting effect which produces fear, discord, and all the rest of it. Right. Now we come to the important part, which relates to Yajnavalkya and Maitreyi. Verily, he had no delight. Therefore, one alone has no delight. He desired a second. It's a curious way of putting it. He desired a second. Remember, coming back from that transcendent state of unitary wholeness, there arises the desire for something else. He desired a second. He was indeed as large as a woman and a man closely embraced. He caused that self to fall into two pieces, to fall apart. Now the Sanskrit root of the verb to fall apart is pat, P-A-T, pat. Therefrom arose a husband, pati, and a wife, patni. You will see the correspondence of this mythological presentation with several of the mythologies of the world. It's the same sort of thing, in various forms, this falling apart. This, here it is presented as a falling apart. In Genesis chapter 2, you find the Lord God makes the woman out of Adam's so-called rib, which is a hopelessly nonsensical translation, but I won't go into that now. We'll go deeply into that some other day and take it all in detail, make some sense of it. But broadly speaking, there is the woman and Adam the man. But this man and this woman are not physical man and physical woman. This is the conceptual man, the conceptual woman. The woman happens to be, now I am going into Genesis, the woman happens to be the heavenly female, not the earthly female, which is Mother Earth itself. The planet Earth is Adama, the feminine of Adam. It's very fascinating. On the woman, no injunction was laid about not eating the fruit which was in the middle of the garden. Only on Adam the injunction was laid. This heavenly woman is not driven out of Eden. It is Adam who is thrown out. And then the Bible just tells us there is a gap in the Bible, actually. And it just goes on to say, and Adam called his wife, he changed the name to Heva. From Isha, this heavenly woman, he changes the name to Heva, the mother of all living. And so it goes on. So you come see the descent down to earth. If you remember that all these characters in the Bible, right up to Abraham, are archetypal figures. They are not living human beings at all. These are ways of teaching profound truths. And you will see the correspondence with this. Now, so this man-woman who are one fall apart, as it is put. That is to say, the maleness and the femaleness, or the positive energy and the negative energy, which are in a unitary condition, now function separately on their own, begin to function separately on their own. Therefore, this is true. Oneself is like a half fragment, as Yajnavalkya used to say. Therefore, this space, now the space referred to here, is this space, you know, he was big as a man and a woman, close combined. So now there is this space, which is a vacancy, since when they have fallen apart. Therefore, this space is filled by a wife. He copulated with her. Therefrom, human beings were produced. And human beings are referred to as manushya in the original Sanskrit text. Manushya means human beings, beings with intelligence, like you and I. You see? She then bethought herself, how does he copulate with me after he has produced me just from himself? Come, let me hide myself. She became a cow. He became a bull. She became a mare. He became a stallion. And so on and so on. And, I mean, this is just a rather crude way of presenting the proliferation in consciousness process. See, this proliferation in consciousness takes place. But now, let's go back to this original husband and wife. This pati, husband referred to, is the sovereign lord. All translators have referred to pati as husband, the ordinary dictionary meaning. I prefer to translate pati in this context as the sovereign lord. And patni is the sovereign lady. The lord and the lady. And they are actually in timeless conjugation. They represent our own being at the transcendent level. We are quite unconscious of all that here. But if you do enter the deep states of meditation, and this opens out to you, you will realize what it means and what it implies. We all know that here on earth, each one of us, whether man or woman, has both elements present, the male and the female element, the masculine and the feminine elements in our being and nature, physically and psychically, both. We are male-female. Now, this earthly male-female has its correspondence in the transcendent sphere of the heavenly male-female. That phrase, marriage made in heaven, has many meanings, not just one or two. Several meanings. It means, in this case, that this mysterious creative power, of which you and I know nothing, in the ordinary way here, this mysterious creative power is positive-negative in nature. If it weren't positive-negative in nature, there could be no interplay, interaction. There could be no becoming process at all. There'd be no such thing as the evolution of a universe and its development and all the rest of it. Right in the ultimate depths of consciousness, there are these two held together like that. The unitary wholeness state which is the supreme state that you and I as human beings can realize, is one in which the sovereign Lord and the sovereign lady, let's put it in the nice artistic form, are a non-duality. The manner in which you are aware of existence is the most important influence, operating power in our lives, our total life. The manner in which we are aware of existence. And in this inmost seat of consciousness, when you have realized, when transcendence is realized through you, that the duals, the male and the female, are in the state of non-duality, and they everlastingly remain in a timeless conjugation. Now, what happens here in this world of things? Conjugation takes place and it comes to an end. This is a finite, mortal realm. And because we do not understand, because we haven't got that penetration and that awareness into transcendence, we are desire-driven. The earthly female is driven by desire. The earthly female in every one of us, whether you be a man or a woman, is driven by desire. The heavenly female is the source of inspiration which gives us vision to realize that immortal unity. And in that realization, there is absolute peace. That is the end of all what we call sex problems or difficulties. Absolute end. You are no longer troubled. This is the husband, not for the love of the husband as a separate, but as part and parcel of that one total reality, that unitary wholeness, that transcendent reality, the Atma, that's what the word Atma stands for, is the husband dear. Now you've got the right relationship. Here we have the wrong relationship. So here there is conjugation, there is falling apart, and there is a drive of desire, the canker of desire, passion, eating away life, and then the physical faculties naturally diminish, decay, and die, and all the psychological and physical and other problems which plague us. Let me read a bit of what I have written for this new book. And this, of course, derives from that. I'm sort of expounding this a bit. Transcendence, heaven and earth are in timeless conjugation. The Holy One's awareness of this in communion he translates as world creation. In ancient days, this was spoken of in the common terms of common creatures, exoterically. The few learned and discovered the inner meaning. In the static undivided, there is no creative action. Wisdom by itself is non-moving. It lives only through love. But without wisdom, joy of love degenerates into destructive lust. When poised by the power of wisdom, joy of love is the bliss of creative action. This is desire divine. Instead of desire, you can say will. Free of binding consequence, the blissful state of perfect union, timeless and deathless, the true meaning of karma or eros. Don't mistake the word karma, K-A with a grave accent, M-A, with karma. Don't mix the two up. Karma is quite different from karma. Karma is translated usually as desire. But karma is the creator of the gods. Just like Eros, if you read your Hesiod carefully, and he's the only one who has presented the transcendent aspect of Eros in that way, it is Eros who is the creator of the gods and the conferrer of immortality. Very significant. Creative action is play, and play is interplay, where transcendence and the shining void intermingle. There rises the stir which is desire, this creative thing. Mystery. Mystery can never be known intellectually by analysis, for mystery cannot be dismembered. That is why you can never penetrate the mystery. You can't dismember it. And therefore, you can never analyze it. And therefore, you can never know it by the brain, with the brain. But the pure one, Purusha, can participate in mystery with loving action, which is unifying understanding. This male, the sovereign lord, and this female, the perpetual feminine, are all-powerful archetypal forces. The conjugative union of this lord and lady is the primordial marriage made in heaven, and from it flow all the archetypes that man has named. Now, you find in the Upanishad, this rather crude presentation, she became a mare, he became a stallion, she became, and so on. This is a way of suggesting the emergence of archetypes, all the archetypal forms in mind. And they are permanent mental forces which affect the life of humanity unbeknown to us human beings. When one has begun to penetrate into this, one sees one's responsibility. How to respond rightly to the archetype? Because this archetypal force from the transcendent realms always throws us a challenge. Now, we have to respond to that challenge in the right way. And in the responding to this challenge, it happens now and again. In fact, very often, we have to break the law, as we call it. That is to say, we have to deviate from the law. On the other hand, we cannot live forever and ever. We must not live or try to live forever and ever, ever and ever, in exact conformity with the law. For this reason, man is a peculiar creation altogether, an extraordinary creation. You and I, human beings, are the only species on this earth who continuously grow upwards. We are the main trunk of the tree of life. All the other species are lateral branches which have their limits with very slight elasticity. Within those limits they can play. But if the animal species cannot adapt itself, cannot respond properly to the circumstance, the species perishes. man has the power to have dominion, as put in Genesis, for instance, over all these things. It, which means not that he is to ruthlessly murder the animals and cut down the forests and all that sort of thing. Not that. It means that he has to be as a sovereign lord unto all these, nurture them and protect them. And in that nurturing and protecting, learn in such a way that his inner vision opens and he goes moving ever upwards, that main trunk of the tree of life. Look at the extraordinary significance that in yoga we adopt this posture as the basic posture. The tree of life, the Ashwatha tree as it is called in India, the roots are the brain. Roots above, the trunk like that, and the branches are the nerves, the nervous system spreading out, which is the opposite of an ordinary tree. In an ordinary tree, your roots are geocentric. They point to the center of the earth, which is a fixed location. This root points to the zenith, which is infinite. There is no end to it. You see the difference? It's not merely symbolic, it is very real. Because that aspect of mind, which of course goes right beyond brain and transcends brain as such, has no spatial limits whatsoever. The brain has its spatial limits. My cranium, that's the end. The brain can't go beyond that. But the brain is the tool of that which is something right beyond physical brain, what we loosely and commonly call mind. And here, the sky is the limit. But where will you find the sky? Where will you catch hold of the sky? You'll never catch it. So now, these archetypal forms are released and they come into consciousness somewhat dimly in most cases as you return to ordinary sense mind functioning. But this basic principle of the male and the female works right through. We are, in fact, a double duality, each one of us. There is that transcendent aspect, which is dual, and which is a non-duality, the sovereign lord and lady, the male-female aspect, which is in timeless conjugation, which means perpetually in creative action. In creative action, which the brain never knows and sees, unless you become the perfected Holy One and enter that state of consciousness. That is the transcendent duality in us. And there is this dual aspect, the male-female in us here, which belongs to the realm of the finite, the mortal, the ignorant state. This is the one of the basic meanings of avidya, used in India. Ignorance as the root of the ill state. It is this ignorance which produces the conflict, the misery, the trouble, and which gives rein to craving. In fact, the very arising of craving is dependent upon this ignorant state. When this ignorance has vanished, then the craving has gone. But don't imagine for a single moment that the mere intellectual knowledge of it, because somebody has spoken about it, or you have read it in a book, is going to dispel ignorance. Not at all. Absolutely not at all. You have to undergo complete purification of the mind. Your whole psychophysical being becomes so purified that it realizes the unconditioned state here and now. And then you are free of that ignorance. Not by mere intellectual knowledge, so many words, so many thoughts. They are helpful. They are in fact indispensable. Otherwise, the scriptures would never have been produced and given to mankind. They are indispensable. But this is the basic and fundamental thing, the purification process. And this is where mindfulness and all the rest of it comes in. So now we see Yajnavalkya's point, don't we? Maitreya asks, would wealth make me immortal or no? Tell me then what you know that I may be immortal. Now, although it is put in those words, it doesn't mean that Maitreya wants to be immortal according to any dictionary definition of the word. Not a bit of it. Because that is quite impossible. Immortality is the truth of your own being when this transcendent communion is realized. Because in that state there is no beginning, there is no proceeding, there is no ending. In that state, to use the biblical phrase, as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, is simultaneously present forever and ever. This you can actually be aware of. And that is immortality. The non-mortality. It is when your consciousness, your discriminative consciousness, vijnana as the Buddhists call it, has gone beyond its discriminativeness. The Buddhists haven't got a word for that. The Upanishads use the word Atma for that. The phrase that the Buddha himself used, you have heard me say it again and again, Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pavam. Discriminative consciousness, vijnanam, but we'll be content with leaving that there. The Buddha himself used it. Discriminative consciousness, anidassanam, which is without any characteristics of this or that. Everything has coalesced into the one unitary whole. Anantam, endless, therefore beginningless. Therefore timeless, beyond all time and space. No dimensions whatsoever. Sabbato, everywhere. Pavam, or the other word used, paham. One means accessible, the other means shining. This is the realization of the deathless state, as the Buddha called it. The immortal state. And Yajnavalkya answers Maitreya, his wife, at the moment of when he was to go away. She would not see him again. You see, he answers her in the language of love. Behold, verily, not for the love of the husband is the husband dear, but for the love of the Atma. And in the realization of that state, the husband is not lost. The physical husband is not lost. Although he has gone away. The physical wife is not lost, although she is away. Sons are not lost. Nothing is lost. Everything is there by itself. And in this immortal awareness, which is the non-possessive awareness, the fearless awareness, there is the complete fulfillment of love in its transcendence and the realization of the immortal truth.